Hey, this is Pirate RC, and I'm talking with Sophie B. Hawkins. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Pirate RC.
Great.
Money will talk for you. Coat your tongue like sugar. Sweet lies to pacify the hunger.
The first thing I just want to ask you is, you have some performances coming up over the summer. Are you excited to get out on the road a little bit?
Yeah, I'm excited to get out again. I've been doing really fun shows. Like, I just was in Milwaukee, I was in Phoenix and Scottsdale, places like that. So I've been happy, really happy performing. And but these next shows are really special because all the money from the shows and from the selling of the CDs of these shows and the merchandise goes to Waterkeeper Alliance, which is dedicated to cleaning up the waters, especially with this big oil spill in the Gulf. And they are the most professional scientific organization. Robert F. Kennedy is the president. And so I've been working with them, and like, I have this new song coming out called The Land, The Sea, and the Sky. It's off my new album, Dream Street and Chance. And you can download it on iTunes soon. And all that money also goes straight to Waterkeeper Alliance. So there's an extra added impetus for me. There's the shows which I love and adore. And anyone who's seen me live knows I absolutely love playing live. And then there's this feeling that I'm doing something more for the world, for the oceans, which is really good. You may be deaf, but every rock and tree is listening. Now I'm out to him, all I won't stoop to your injustice. You are the greatest people on the earth, their roads and children are. And I am grateful to be in this country now, but I will never forget the land and sea and sky.
How did you get involved with this organization?
When the spill first happened, and then I was researching, I found a lot of information on the internet was basically that the nature will handle it better themselves. Most people get in the way if they try and clean up, if they try and help animals. So when I found Waterkeeper Alliance, and some people had recommended it to me, because, you know, I've been an activist for a really long time, and I know a lot of people. You know, Mary Steenburgen and Ted Danson, they do incredible work, like Ted Danson's company, Oceana. So they've been doing this stuff for years and years and years and years. So really, I have experts to bounce my ideas off of. And this is the company that everyone said, oh, my dog. Oh, sorry. That's my dog.
That's okay. No problem.
She's actually growling over a soy hot dog. Isn't that funny? Anyway, so that's crazy. So that's how, because they're all marine biologists. If you go to their website, you'll immediately see how good they are. They're all marine biologists. They're really trained. They're not just the guy walking down to the water and saying, I really want to help this bird. And they've been doing it and doing it. And they're also involved on the government level trying to stop. Like, for instance, when the spill happened and BP wouldn't really take much responsibility, and then they started dumping this chemical into the water to break up the oil, which was more toxic than the oil itself. So they're involved on those intricate levels of saying, you know, the regulation of the cleanup that BP is doing, not just what we can do. And basically, what we have to do is get BP to be responsible, because they're the ones, well, and our government, too. Our government did not insist that they were regulated, which is crazy. Because one thing was we weren't supposed to have offshore drilling with this new administration. The next thing is they didn't even regulate it. They gave BP a pass, which is wrong. And it just shows you that it doesn't matter who's in the Oval Office. It's about big corporations, and that's what America has to get to, is that we have to regulate if we're going to drill, which, you know, we might have to drill.
Right, yeah, and it was just interesting timing with the whole thing happening, and where, you know, President Obama was just talking about offshore and things like that, too, and then just the timing was incredible.
Hey, isn't that interesting? But, you know, also, I think that a lot of people keep saying, well, why isn't this in the media more? Like, you know, certain disasters get more exposure than others, and my honest opinion, RC, is that this doesn't make the Obama administration look good, because they gave BP a pass to drill
sure.
those really deep waters. And so That's why it's not like Haiti made the Obama administration look good, because everyone was texting $10, and this one basically is quiet, you know, and it shouldn't be quiet because it's going to affect us for years and years and years. And look how many fishermen it's going to affect. Look how many livelihoods this is going to affect, not just the plankton and the birds and all that, but humans.
You're right. Like, this doesn't make anyone look good. The financial impact, like with oil, no one wants to talk about, right? Because no one wants
exactly.
to talk about the fact that, in a way, there's like a necessary evil involved with oil too that
right.
kind of always gets pushed aside. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it's tough. So it is important that we have people speaking, you know, not only for the environment, for the people who will be hurt by this also. And
yeah, so like I think it's sort of like $600 million or something dollars in one season.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how much more the Gulf can take.
You're mentioning Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. I know you were involved in the Clinton campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, let me be specific, a little while back. And actually, I personally also, I went to Texas for a little while just and campaigned a little bit and helped during their primary and saw Ted Danson there and saw his wife there, Mary Steenburgen. And it was an incredible experience to be involved in all that. And just what was it like for you? And had you been involved in political campaigns prior to that at all?
No, and I had the same experience as you did. I had never been involved, and my manager, Gigi Gaston, said, you have to get involved with Hillary. And my first, you know, instinct was, no, I can't get involved with politics. It'll kill me.
Right.
And then I did, and then I fell so in love with Hillary and everyone I met. And that's how I met Mary Steenburgen. That's how I met everyone. And then I met Bill, and I was like, I was blown away by the intelligence and the heart and soul of these people. I would do anything for Hillary Clinton and Chelsea and Bill and all of them. I love them so much. It was the greatest experience of my life because I've never been with people on that level of thinking before. And the one thing about the music business is you don't get to meet people often who really have their own opinions. A lot of people follow. And that's great if you're just a musician or an artist, you know, artists get on the bandwagons all the time.
Right.
And that's great because that feels good and it seems right at the time. But when I was around the Hillary people, these were people who really thought about things, who'd been thinking about them so long. I mean, they knew so much, and it really made me see, oh, God, I've got to be more involved again, and I've got to really think about what I'm doing and not just have a knee-jerk reaction like, you know, am I just a liberal who goes along with every liberal platitude, or am I really, you know, conservative in some ways? And what do I really want for this world? It really made me become a more responsible citizen. Suddenly I was an American citizen, not just a person who loved the world and loved the earth and loved everybody. I suddenly became really affected and wanting to do things that I thought would be right. And then also I was pregnant with my son, Dashiell.
Oh, wow.
The whole time.
Yeah.
I know. So when I met these people, I was just hoping they were rubbing off on him. Just the sheer, like, brain power of these people is crazy. And not all. I mean, I would say most politicians is probably not the truth, although I haven't met them. But the Clintons in particular, they just got something going on there upstairs.
Not just red and blue. She'll give you something sweet each time she comes inside your neighborhood. Well, is she just too good? A woman's place is in the White House. Damn, I wish you were present.
Also, you're touching on something that I think is important too, of just becoming like a more responsible person, like knowing your opinions can hold a lot of weight and knowing what you go along with can hold so much weight, not just for you, but I mean, you're someone who's more in the public eye, of course. So right. You know, people are going to listen to what you say and tend to take it to heart a different way. But all of us, you know, we're not just a liberal or just a conservative or anything like that. I think that
you're right.
There's
media is really being divisive about it, and more than ever, I think, or probably I'm just noticing it more than ever, because that's why I never wanted to get involved, because I always thought, well, I'll be pigeonholed like everyone is about everything. But like, I sat at this meeting yesterday, and it was about Waterkeeper Alliance, and it was with the publicist who wanted to help me get the message out more. She didn't work for Waterkeeper, but she was trying to help me in the publicity way. So mm-hmm. So she said something like, Americans are really dumb. I wanted to say, but it was biting my tongue, you mean you're really dumb. Because what I'm finding, and I'll be totally honest, is Americans are not dumb. But the media tries to play that we're dumb. And that's their biggest excuse for not giving us the truth. And like, even Obama gave a speech at some college the other day, said, you know, there's too much information out there. And I think there's too little information. There's too many lies. There's too much manipulation. But I don't think there's too much information, because people are being scammed right and left. For you know, we are, I think as an American people, we would be more together than we know if we actually stopped listening to the media and started talking to each other. Because, like I said, I'm conservative in some levels, I'm liberal on some levels, but most people are that way. Most people have family members who are totally different from them, and they love them anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I grew up in that home where I was kind of almost ridiculous, but then as I've gotten older and more mature and things have changed in my parents' lives, you know, we found that there are more commonalities. And
exactly, you're just saying it, and you know what you're saying is so important, because that's the way it's supposed to be. When we're young, we're supposed to be full of fire, and we're supposed to be rebelling against everything and saying, you know, all the old people are ruining everything. And then when you start to mature, you realize there's a lot of great things that we will lose if we're not a little conservationist. And that's what I consider conservative. It's more conservationist. It's thinking before you act. It's taking all sides into account. That's how I consider it. And it's not being like, you know, oh, yeah, let's just dump this whole system. Let's trash the Constitution. Let's just start again. But, you know, that's not going to work either. Everything has, it's like, it's not going to work at all. In fact, I think the Constitution is where our strongest identity is and where our best element is. And so I really have a hard time in my particular seat describing to people what it is I feel, because it's not at all what people think I should feel.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. Kind of a segue from that, and we'll see how it works, but a while back you started your own record label.
Yes.
And that was, I think, a different way of you coming and standing up for yourself and not taking it anymore from the major label. And you're one of the first ones to do that. I've spoken with a couple people. Josh Kelly is one that comes to mind, who started his own label because of, you know, just kind of creatively he needed to do what he needed to do. So how has that changed you too, just having your own label and empowering yourself that way?
That was a great experience, in the sense that what you just said, I was really adamant about being the songwriter first, like starting from the very simple level. I've always written my own songs, and so that means I've written the hits, and I've always really identified as the writer. And the performer was secondary, or even third down the list. You know, the writer, the musician, and then the performer, mm-hmm. and then the name. So when Sony said, you know, well, yeah, you've done all your records, but now it's time for you to start writing with people. And I said, I don't want to write with people, because I have a good track record, better than the people you want me to write with. They've never had hits. And I really want to go to sleep at night knowing that I can do this. It's a big challenge. It's like a painter is a painter. You know, mm-hmm. a writer is a writer. So those were our first huge fights, that I wasn't going to conform. And they go, it's different now. You need 10 writers on a track. You need the producers to write. We can't be sure anything's hit, whatever. So I rejected not just the label's point of view, but the whole way that the industry was going. I said, this is a wrong way for humanity, for artists.
Right.
If somebody buying your record cannot trust that you've even written the songs, which is the case now. You know, somebody's name will be on, the artist's name might be on the song, but you don't really know if they wrote it. And I said to myself, I don't want to live like that. I want to be the true artist, even if I die poor or live poor. It doesn't matter, because that's what makes me happy and that's what makes me sleep at night. So that was the fight, and I left under those circumstances. that I was, and so I got my masters back, and I got my, for that album, it was called Timber, and I was able to start out on my own. It was like for the first time being a small business owner, which is why, again, I relate so much to what's going on in this country now, how they're really crippling small business owners from surviving, because the big corporations are really trying to snuff them out.
Yeah.
Because it's a global government, a global mentality, and they don't care about the guy, you know, on Figueroa Street who has, you know, whatever, a knitting store or something.
Yeah.
They're going to make it impossible, and more so. So I was in that, I was, you know, Joe Schmo, wanting to do my own small business because I wanted to be an artist, and I cared about, number one, the quality of my songs. I cared about the integrity of my identity, I guess, and I cared about the process. And those are all the things that anyone can relate to, whether you're not an art, whether you're an artist or not, whether you make shoes or whether you make records.
Yeah.
So that's what I did, and it did empower me. It was also the greatest struggle of my life because, you know, I had been supported since Tongues and Tails, like, you know, if I wanted to make a video, if I, they had really thrown money at my career, not thrown it in the back. Actually, they had given me very little money compared to other artists, but I had gotten, relatively to now, a lot of support.
Right.
And I didn't know it at the time. I thought that they were giving me very little support, which, relative to what I should have gotten on the label, it was little, but relative to now, it was tremendous. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's all these things we're talking about, perspective, you know, growing up and maturing. Had I known what it was going to be like to try and support myself and have my own label, I might have not done it. But I was young and full of fire, and I said, I'm going to do this. And you know what? I'm still doing it, and I'm still surviving, and I love my new record. And so I can say that it's been really good. I would never advise it to somebody who's really not willing to live modestly and stuff. I don't know how I've managed to do so well and still tour. I don't know how I do it, except that people love what I've said. They love the integrity. They love the honesty.
Yeah, I think fans are kind of hungry for authentic, you know, musicians, authentic songwriters, because even going to performances for certain artists, you don't know that you're even going to hear them perform, you know, and it's
kind
of...
You're so right. You don't know who's, you know, whose voice is it? Is it pitch corrected? And all this stuff. I think you're right, and I think that hunger's always going to be there. And I had an artist in my studio. She's 18 years old now, Nicole. She's a phenomenal painter. And she's just starting out her life, and she knows she's going to be a painter. And she was talking about, well, there's not many women in museums and there's not many women painters exhibited. And I said, but you know, it's also a blessing for you because there's a hunger for you now that you're a female artist. And she's really phenomenal. And so she was saying that she was maybe a little bit trepidatious about it. But I said, really, it'll work in your favor in the end if you really can stick to and be a true artist who you are now. And I know she has no choice. And then she said, but, you know, the struggle of it. And I go, but you have no choice. If you weren't an artist, you'd struggle even more because you'd know that you sold yourself, you sold your soul if you didn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's not relative to anyone. Like, no one really can sell out. I don't believe in selling out. But I do believe you know when you haven't done your best as a person.
Yeah, and you kind of, you know when you're not doing what you love, too. I mean, it's
pretty clear. Exactly, and your life is reflecting that.
Yeah, for sure. For your new album, first of all, when is that coming out?
Dream Street and Chance. I don't know when it's coming out because this opportunity, like with this song, Land in the Sea and the Sky, that's presented like a window. I really am looking for opportunities because you can't just put out an album anymore. I mean, as you know, people really only want one song or four songs at a time.
Right.
They're not really going to go look for your album. So unless I'm on at a concert selling my CDs, they're not even going to notice that there is an album. So this song will go out there, and then I'm shopping it, basically. I have these interesting, you know, there's always companies out there who are willing to put out an independent artist and put a little money behind it. But what I really want are these opportunities that the music fits, because to just put the album out and no one knows it's out there is such a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did with Wilderness. What a struggle and what a drain. And it was good because it taught me. It taught me you really have to match the song with the important event, whether you get it in a movie or you're doing a charity thing or whatever. Because otherwise, it's just there's too much out there and no one's ever going to know Sophie B. Hawkins did anything.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I think the whole digital concept now, it's something that people can leverage really well, but it can also, you know, be a detriment when there is just so much for people to search through, I think.
You're so right. And that's why when my manager, Gigi, she presented this incredible opportunity of writing a musical. It's for Kristen Chenoweth, and we're workshopping it in June, actually, in New York. It's actually come to the point, which is, if you know anything about musicals, it's almost impossible. But sure. We have an incredible director, a Tony-winning director, you know, the Tony-winning star, and the book writing partner is Thomas Meehan, who wrote Annie and Hairspray and all these incredible Broadway plays, musicals. So anyways, we're really doing well in the sense that it's attracted the great people to help us bring it to the level it's supposed to be at. And I'm writing all the songs and the music with a dead guy. The guy who wrote the original, he died in the 40s. His name is Eugene Burton, so now I'm taking it from there. And he's written about half, and I've written about half, and it's phenomenal. I mean, I think it's phenomenal. The opportunity is phenomenal. So anyways, as I struggle with my career, and I mean it as a good struggle, as I struggle to get my music out there, and I have this Broadway show, which is also my music, and it's a whole other side of me, and I get to be ultimately incredibly creative there.
Yeah.
That I'm now having to expand, and I think that's good, too.
That's fantastic, and I think, well, Spring Awakening was created by a pop star, and
yes.
I think that kind of really revitalized Broadway quite a bit.
Yeah,
I mean, it was so different and just, it was incredible. And so that's a good opportunity right now, too, just to come in when people are ready to see musicals again. And I think people want them.
Yeah, and you're right. And they want that fresh perspective of not the same old. I mean, forgive me for saying it. I respectfully say, you know, the same writers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All pop writers have a chance to grow and expand. And yet, there's another thing, too, is you can do a totally pop musical, like, I guess Jesus Christ Superstar did it way back then.
Yeah.
And it was really a rock musical. And Spring Awakening was, in many ways, a pop musical. But then there's the Broadway thing, which is also very interesting, where you have to have true rhymes and really write Broadway songs. And when I say Broadway, I don't mean, it doesn't have to be a cliche or tacky, but there's those things about Broadway that are really beautiful that people like, you know, Frank Lesser, who did Guys and Dolls. I mean, there's great, great writers who did Broadway, and they stayed true to a certain tradition. And the musical I'm doing isn't really a pop musical in that sense. It has those elements, but it's actually more of a classic musical. And that's been the challenge for me. And I signed on board not to do Sophie B. Hawkins' music, but to do really a classic musical, and it's been incredible.
Yeah.
Then to be able to write for other characters, like to be writing for a 6-year-old drunken father is just fabulous, and his daughter, you know, and they're splitting up, I mean, in this particular story. And it's just amazing to be able to write from different characters' perspectives. And it's funny, too, because it's a comedy, actually, too. It's a romantic comedy, I guess. And the funny songs, oh, my God, for me to be able to be funny, such a relief. Because I really, that's like my, if you heard my live album, the part in me that's never really come out enough, but it comes out on stage, is my humor. And it doesn't come out because I'm so serious in my songwriting, really. But when I get on stage, it's just joke after joke, you know? So then in these songs, because it's a comedy in many ways, some of the funniest lines, I swear to God, I've ever written. And I really laugh myself and I go, this is fun. This is fun.
Well, then
funny.
You're going to have someone incredible delivering your lines too, which and your songs, which is great. I mean, as far as Kristen Chenoweth goes,
I can't even imagine. I can imagine, and it's going to start happening soon. But really, every day I just pray that it keeps going because we've been so lucky. Not lucky, it's like blessed. I don't know.
Yeah, no, and to workshop in New York is great too.
Yeah, and you know that's where I'm from, so in a way, I kept praying for the musical to bring me home again.
On your label, do you have any other artists signed, or do you ever want to go in that direction to produce other artists?
Yeah, I do, and I've worked with other artists, and it hasn't gone anywhere, except I love what I've done, and the artists loved it, but they didn't get picked up. Like, I wanted to produce them and write with them and have them picked up by someone who had a lot of money. And so far, none of the artists have been picked up, and I was really disappointed, because I put everything into these people, and then it didn't get picked up. But you know, the songs are still there, and the recordings are still there, and it may someday get in movies and whatever. The problem with this record label, and I'm sure anyone who has a record label understands this, if you don't have a lot of people working for you, I think of all these things, oh, you know, we should be submitting that artist's songs too.
Right.
Well, but I don't have freaking time, and we can't afford as many people as we need. And then, but that'll all happen. Like, again, one thing just has to give, like this musical or a single, another single of mine, and then it changes the whole landscape. But yes, I've worked with artists. And then I just did something for this artist really recently. I did a track for her, and she sang it, and I wrote the whole thing, and I produced it, and she got a deal.
Oh, perfect.
Amazing deal. I know, and I was, Gigi brought her to me. Gigi's really, really good at finding people, and this one, I didn't know what was going to happen, but Gigi was right, and it was a phenomenal experience, and a really easy one, too. So I don't know if I'll get to work more with her on the album, but she's now got a real deal, and hopefully they'll use a song. I suspect they will, because that's what they fell in love with her for, was this particular song, but we'll see.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, in general, can you tell me what inspires you? I mean, you've inspired a documentary previously, right?
Yeah.
The Cream Will Rise, and it seems like, just in talking to you, I could say, you know, just making a difference and change. But what's inspiring you right now, just in your work?
This, I really, really want to be part of the world in a deeper way through my work. And I can see it starting to happen, where I'm starting to connect. Like these shows that I'm doing, for instance, in Milwaukee, there was a girl who was 20 years old. There was a couple of people who were 20 years old in that range. And I said, what brought you here? And you know, each one had a different reason of what brought them here, how they found the music. And then there was people who were like 70 years old there. And I said, what brought you guys here? And then I realized, you know, I'm starting to make the connection that I'm really yearned to make my whole life. In my song, I Walk Alone, I said I wanted to be loved, I wanted to be known. No, I wanted to be held, I wanted to be thrown into the world. Ever since I was little, I've wanted to be, like, you know how the Clintons are part of the world.
Yeah.
And they get to do these, and I'll never get to be like a Clinton, but I'll get to be Sophie B. Hawkins connecting to people on a higher level and doing more things that mean things. And I'm starting to get to that place, and I've been working towards it. And my X factor, the part of me that's been holding me back, has been me. And so really I've worked through, I guess, a lot of mistrust and all this stuff that, and the documentary shows a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like I've been able to be this person, but I kept pulling myself back and going into the cave again. And now I feel like I don't have to do that, so hopefully the connection will keep growing. That's what it really inspires me a lot, is like when you reach someone and you know you've reached them and you've connected. And it's really profound because it's not based on one aspect. It's this total creative inspiration, which includes love and sex and nature and everything great in that moment. That's what we want.
I wanted to be loved. I wanted to be known. I wanted to be held. I wanted to be thrown into this world. I wanted to be your little girl. I wanted to be shy. I wanted to be dumb. I wanted to be blind. I wanted to be young as a child.
Do you remember what the first live show was that you went to?
That I went to? You mean not like a Broadway show or Gilbert and Sullivan when I was a kid?
Yeah, or maybe like live concert, yeah.
Okay, the first live concert was in Pennsylvania it was The Who.
Really?
I went with Bill Jones, actually, from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I was probably 13, and that was a really great experience, but we were so far back. I think we also, in that same year, saw the Grateful Dead. We saw the Keith Richards. Remember when he did with, what were they called, the New Barbarians? And I saw David Bowie. That was like, I saw a lot of stuff. But you know, you want to know something? That was probably the first, but then after that, I saw all these jazz shows in New York, because then I fell in love with my drum teacher, who was like 45, and he took me to 14th Street clubs, and oh god, what's his name? Big Joe Turner. That's the one I remember most. He's dead too.
And then when did you get into music as far as just playing and writing? And
oh, I can tell you the exact, now that date I remember exactly, because I was sitting on the couch, I was stoned out of my mind. My Aunt Linda, who I called Nino, she was stoned out of her mind, and we were sitting there, and I said, Aunt Nino, I've got to play African drums. And she didn't even bat an eye. She goes, I know an African drum teacher. Huh. Oh, my God, really? So she set it up. She set up the lesson. So I went there after, didn't go to basketball practice. I went to 57th Street where that death slide is, that black building that looks like a slide right across from there. I had my first lesson, and that was it. And that was the drum teacher that really changed my life. It was like I was meant to meet him. And it was like I had been made to wait until that age, because I really had wanted to play drums all my life and kept just funny stories of me always trying to find a teacher, trying to find a lesson, whatever. I couldn't get it together. And then it happened. And then it changed my life from that moment on, that spring night.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. I was old, though, see? Like, I was 14.
Well,
I wasn't one of these kids who were trained.
Yeah, who was, like, formally...
Right.
Trained from a young age to, you know, start with the classical and get going.
I was so untrained. And then when I started wanting to be a singer, a songwriter type of thing, like I had then been through drums and then vibraphone and marimba, and I was really big on jazz. Like I wanted to be a great jazz player. Then when I finally got back to, you know, songwriting, and I say back to because I'd grown up listening to Bob Dylan, so somewhere in my mind I knew I was supposed to be that. When I finally sat down on the piano and started writing, and then I had bands, I was from behind the drums. I was singing from behind the drum set, and the guys in the band used to apologize for me, for my voice. Because they all thought my songs were cool, but I mean, can you imagine? I've really come a long way.
Yeah, from behind a set of drums to being out front. And
yeah, and just like, you know, knowing that I think now the traditional pop singer is so trained, and, you know, the parents are getting them to sing on the street when they're 3 years old, mm-hmm. you know, to track. But I was the opposite story. Hey, baby, here's my son. That's all. Oh, my God, you little cutie. If you could see this kid. Oh, my God, you're so cute.
All right, well, thanks a lot for chatting with us. And you guys, if you can catch Sophie B. Hawkins on the road, definitely do that. Again, all the money from the tour and you said merchandise sales, right, from the tour?
Yes.
We'll go to the Waterkeeper Alliance.
Go to my website, to sophiebhawkins.com, and it will have all the links to the charity and stuff.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
I am grateful to be in this country now, but I will never forget the land.